On this episode of The Mystery File, I'm going to talk about a really disturbing case out of British Columbia, Canada, which happens to be the same location for another episode on this podcast called Who Killed Realtor Lindsay Buziak? This case is just as baffling and mysterious. For almost 7 years, Cindy James was terrorized by a sadistic stalker who repeatedly attacked her and almost burned down her house. And that wasn't even the worst of it. Police said that Cindy didn't have a stalker. She was committing all those horrific acts herself. Then one day, the 44-year-old nurse ended up dead, her arms and feet bound with rope. Who killed her and why? Cindy was the eldest of six children, born in Oliver, British Columbia, to a Polish officer in the Canadian Army and his wife. She wrote in her diaries that her father was strict and used corporal punishment on her. She spent part of her youth in Ottawa, the capital city of Canada. In 1962, the 18-year-old enrolled in nursing school. At the time, her family was living in Metz, France, while her father worked for NATO. In letters to them, Cindy sometimes wrote about a guy she had met. She claimed that they were engaged at one point. After finding out he had terminal cancer, the man took his life while they were on a skiing trip. Her family never met the man or learned his name. In 1965, Cindy met Roy Makepeace, a psychiatrist from South Africa who was 18 years older than her. The two married in 1966, the same year she graduated from nursing school. Cindy's parents were not too pleased with that marriage, considering the big age difference. And her father felt that Roy had taken advantage of Cindy, who he described as naive and gullible. As her family later testified, the couple's marriage wasn't exactly blissful. Cindy accused Roy of domestic violence, but he claimed he only slapped her twice the whole time they were married. In September 1982, Cindy and Roy divorced. That's when the alleged harassment started. She told her friends and family that a prowler had been lurking around her house. She also said that she was getting obscene phone calls from someone speaking in different voices. Sometimes it was just whispering. Other times, there was just silence on the other end. She said that she didn't recognize the caller. Cindy reported the calls to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, or RCMP. They visited her house and suggested she keep a list of each call, as well as get an unlisted number. In October, she reported to police that someone had thrown a rock through one of her windows, entered her house, and slashed a bed pillow. A Vancouver police constable named Pat McBride suspected that the culprit was Cindy's ex-husband, Roy Makepeace, but he denied being involved. Two tenants who rented Cindy's basement reported to police that one day they heard strange noises upstairs on the main floor after Cindy had left for work. A next-door neighbor told Constable McBride that she'd seen a man who didn't look like Roy standing outside Cindy's house on at least three different occasions. One time, the man entered Cindy's front gate. Soon, Cindy and Constable McBride started dating, and he moved into her house. He continued to be the investigating officer on her case while living with her. One day, the constable found Roy sitting in his parked car in an alley behind the house. When questioned, Roy claimed he was trying to catch Cindy's alleged stalker in the act, but he left when the constable told him that he was looking out for her now. The constable's presence in Cindy's house did not scare off her mysterious stalker, however. She continued to receive obscene phone calls, one of which was traced to a business in the Vancouver suburb of Richmond. Another time, the phone lines outside her house had been cut in 5 different places. Cindy started getting threatening and bizarre notes with cut and paste letters and graphic photos. One note pinned to her car windshield had a picture of a corpse lying under a medical sheet. Another note left outside her house was stained with red ink and had a photo of a woman with her throat slashed. Cindy's relationship with the constable did not last long. He moved out of the house and lost interest in finding her tormentor. In January 1983, Cindy's friend Agnes Woodcock found her lying unconscious in her backyard with a nylon stocking wrapped around her neck. After regaining consciousness, Cindy told Agnes that an unknown assailant attacked her from behind as she walked to her garage. The individual brought her into the garage where another guy was waiting. She said that the two men violated her with a knife and threatened to kill her younger sister, Melanie, if she reported the attack. Then they strangled her. If these men were her stalkers, who had been threatening to kill her for months, why would they leave her alive? Doctors who examined Cindy after the alleged attack found no evidence that she had been sexually assaulted. Police were starting to think, okay, this woman has some serious issues. They asked her to see a psychiatrist, but Cindy declined at first because she didn't want to be stigmatized. At this time, Cindy was working at Vancouver's Blindheim House, a facility caring for children with behavioral and emotional issues. Her colleagues described her as being competent and professional. Cindy moved to a house in West Vancouver, but still received obscene calls and threatening notes. One of them said, "Run, rabbit, run. I'll show you how bleeping good I am. Soon, bang, bang, you're dead." 2 months later, she moved again to another house and repainted her car. Meanwhile, her ex-husband Roy was over there trying to win her back. He showered her with lavish gifts and even paid for her to go visit one of her brothers, who was living in Indonesia. After returning from the trip, Cindy found another bizarre note, which said, "Welcome back, death, blood, hate, etc." She also discovered 3 strangled cats in her garden that had been bound with rope. Cindy hired a private investigator named Ozzy Caban. He said that she wore a portable panic button and carried pepper spray with her at all times. Even though her number was unlisted, she continued to receive numerous phone calls at home and at work. Some of her coworkers answered these calls and said that the anonymous caller did not speak. Cindy's father told Unsolved Mysteries, "She was very reluctant to talk about what was going on, right to the end. Our feeling was that she was withholding something." In January 1984, Ozzy, the private investigator, overheard strange noises on a two-way radio he had given Cindy. He went to her house, but Cindy didn't come to the door, and it was locked. After breaking down the door, he went inside the house and found her lying unconscious on her living room floor. She had a nylon stocking wrapped tightly around her neck, and someone had stuck a knife through her hand with a cut and paste note attached that said, "Now you must die, cunt." Cindy was taken to a local hospital. She told police that a man came through her gate, bludgeoned her over the head with a blunt object, and inserted a hypodermic needle into her arm. She gave no description of this attacker. Doctors found a needle mark in her right arm, but found no traces of any drugs in her system. Constable Keo Ikoma, who was the responding officer, stated that he observed blood smeared in circular patterns on the kitchen floor, as though someone had attempted to clean up evidence. Police questioned Cindy several times. In one interview, she said, "All of a sudden, there was someone behind me, and I don't know where he came from. I was trying to push his knife away. I don't think I remember anything else. They had her take not one, but two polygraphs, which were inconclusive. Both tests showed Cindy was withholding information. Her private investigator, Ozzie, said she would be evasive. She would withhold information and not act as a normal victim would act. I could see how police would have tremendous problem believing her story. Cindy's mother claimed she was reluctant to talk because she was trying to protect her family. Cindy told me after she was attacked, a knife was held to her throat, her mother said, and she was told to keep quiet or her sister and mother would be next. Police asked Cindy who she thought was tormenting her, and she pointed the finger right at her ex-husband, Roy Makepeace. So they questioned him, and he theorized that Cindy's attackers were part of the mafia and connected to her employment at Blenheim House, a place that treated children who were wards of the court. Police had Cindy's father wear a wiretap to try to get a confession out of Roy, but he maintained his ridiculous theory that the mafia was after Cindy. One day, Cindy called Ozzie in a panic, and he rushed over to her house. He found her cowering in the garden. She claimed someone had broken into the house. Ozzie found her poor dog in the basement. She had been physically abused and had a rope around her. Next to the dog was some sexually explicit photos and a happy birthday note. Ozzie did not believe that Cindy would harm her own dog, stating, "She'd never have done that if she was the Cindy I knew." In July, Cindy told Ozzie that two men had arrived at her front door posing as police officers, but fled when she radioed him. Apparently, Cindy's co-worker at Blenheim House received a call from an unknown person who said, "Get rid of the big pig." Later that month, Cindy's mother spent the night at her house. In the middle of the night, the mother awoke to the dog barking and found Cindy checking windows and doors on the main floor of the house. Moments later, they both heard the doorbell ring and discovered a window near the front porch cracked in several areas. 2 weeks later, Cindy claimed she was attacked by an assailant in a park while walking her dog at approximately 8:30 p.m. This time, she gave a description. She said her attacker was a bearded man driving a green van, and he had a female passenger. Around midnight, she was found in a dazed state attempting to enter the home of a neighbor, and a dark gray nylon stocking was around her neck. Her dog was later found wandering alone in a nearby park. Cindy was taken to a hospital, where doctors found two puncture marks in her right arm. While she was being treated, a hospital receptionist told authorities that a man with an accent had called the front desk, inquiring about the hospital's security policies. When police played audio of Roy's voice, the receptionist felt there was a strong possibility it was the same person. While under hypnosis in October 1984, Cindy recounted a repressed memory of witnessing a double murder, but did not provide further details. Meanwhile, police surveilled her home, but were never able to catch anyone in the act. They also tried to trace the anonymous phone calls she received, but none were long enough to be traced. While under hypnosis again, Cindy told police that she had witnessed her ex-husband brutally murder a man and a woman with an ex while the couple was vacationing at a cabin on Thornbee Island in July 1981. She claimed that Roy smeared some of the victim's blood on her face. Cindy's sister Melanie had gone on vacation with them, and she denied anything like that happening. In late June 1985, Cindy was involuntarily committed to a psychiatric unit at Vancouver's Lionsgate Hospital after overdosing on prescription pills. The following month, she agreed to allow police to wiretap a phone conversation with Roy, during which she accused him of terrorizing her and murdering the two people she told police about. Roy absolutely denied the allegations and called Cindy insane and said she was involved in an enormous revenge fantasy. Following the recorded call, the RCMP employed officers to maintain 24-hour surveillance of Cindy, Roy, and two other unnamed suspects over a week-long period. But of course, nothing happened. Police actually investigated Cindy's wild claim that Roy killed two people, but they found no evidence of any murders or missing person cases at Thornmimby Island. And they were never able to locate the cabin Cindy described where the crime allegedly took place. In early July, Cindy received a package at her house containing a charcoal-colored nylon stocking, along with a note that said, "Blood flowing freely." Several weeks later, she found a container on her front porch that had rotten meat from a small animal. On August 5th, Cindy reported a fire in her house. Authorities found what appeared to be pieces of burnt newspaper scattered in a room. She reported another fire the following day. Later that month, a third fire broke out in Cindy's basement bathroom at about 4:45 a.m. The window of the bathroom was partially open, but the soot and dust on the windowsill showed no markings that an intruder had entered or exited through the window. Charred remnants of a newspaper were discovered in the bathroom. A detective who investigated said that he believed Cindy had started the fire herself. Firefighters and police overheard Cindy in a heated conversation with her investigator, Ozzy, explaining that she had taken her dog out for a walk at 3:15 a.m. and returned home to discover the fire. If your life is being threatened, why would you go outside by yourself at that time? It doesn't make sense. In the fall of 1985, a female Vancouver police officer named Carol Halliday requested that a psychologist interview Cindy. Carol believed she was committing all those criminal acts herself, and said that the male officers who investigated the case were conned by the histrionics of a pretty woman. Based on his interviews with Cindy and analysis of police records, Dr. Anthony Marcus concluded that she was suffering from dissociative identity disorder, stemming from a traumatic childhood incident, though he did not question her about her early life during their interviews. According to the Mayo Clinic, dissociative disorders are mental disorders that involve experiencing a disconnection and a lack of continuity between thoughts, memories, surroundings, actions, and identity. People with these disorders escape reality in ways that are involuntary, unhealthy, and cause problems with functioning in everyday life. Dissociative disorders usually develop as a reaction to trauma and help keep difficult memories at bay. Dissociative identity disorder, or DID, is characterized by switching to alternate identities. People suffering from DID may feel the presence of two or more people talking or living inside their heads, and may feel as though they're possessed by other identities. Each identity may have a unique name, personal history, and characteristics, including obvious differences in voice, gender, and mannerisms. Signs and symptoms of DID may include memory loss, a sense of being detached from yourself and your emotions, a perception of the people and things around you as distorted and unreal, a blurred sense of identity, significant stress or problems in your relationships, work, or other important areas of your life, inability to cope well with emotional or professional stress, mental health problems such as depression, anxiety, and suicidal thoughts and behaviors. People with DID can also have dissociative fugue, which happens when they temporarily lose their sense of personal identity and impulsively wander or travel away from their homes or places of work. The National Alliance on Mental Health says that women are more likely than men to be diagnosed with DID. In December 1985, Cindy moved to a new house in Richmond, British Columbia. That month, she was found by passing motorists lying dazed and semi-conscious in a ditch about 6 miles from her house. Cuts and abrasions covered her body. She was wearing a man's work boot and glove. As you probably guessed, she had a black nylon stocking wrapped tightly around her neck. Cindy was rushed to the hospital, where she was treated for hypothermia. When interviewed in the hospital, Cindy said all she could remember was getting lunch during her break and stopping by a pharmacy. After her release from the hospital, she flew to Germany to visit her brother for Christmas. In early 1986, Cindy formally changed her last name from Makepeace back to her maiden name, James. She asked her friends Agnes and Tom Woodcock to spend the night at her house. Agnes said, "Cindy told me many times, he doesn't want to kill me. He wants to scare me." She didn't elaborate who that he was. One night, Cindy woke up the couple and said she heard a loud noise downstairs. The three went downstairs, only to find the basement on fire. When they attempted to call the fire department, they discovered that the line was dead. Tom ran across the street to a neighbor's house to call 911. As he was leaving, he saw a man standing by Cindy's house. Tom said when he approached him, the man fled on foot. Cindy went to stay with the Woodcocks for several days following the fire, but refused to eat and made comments that her life was no longer worth living. Her psychotherapist, who believed her claims, had her committed to the psychiatric ward of St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver. Ellen Connolly told Unsolved Mysteries, "One of the things she found most difficult was people didn't believe her. That was what drove her crazy, the fact that she wasn't believed." Doctors determined that she was suffering from anorexia and depression. While she was institutionalized, Cindy wrote a note saying that she was going to take her own life after she was released because no one believed her claims that she was being stalked and harassed. She was transferred to another hospital where a comprehensive psychological examination was conducted. The report noted that she maintained good eye contact except when discussing the incidents. She would look down or cover her eyes and speak haltingly. She was upset and cried a great deal when relating these incidents and kept asking if her responses to the items indicated that she was crazy. After a 10-week hospital stay, Cindy was released. She told her family that she had been in fact withholding information regarding her alleged attacks and knew who the perpetrator was. She said that if police couldn't solve it, she would solve it for them. In August 1987, Cindy began working as a nurse at Richmond Hospital. That month, her home alarm went off after someone broke a back window. And 3 days later, she reported to police that someone had loosened her front porch light bulbs. The following week, she reported that someone had used a glass cutter to create a hole in the basement door window. In February 1988, Cindy indicated that someone had shattered a window in her home after securing it with electrical tape. A few months later, Roy received a creepy voice message on his home answering machine. He gave the tape to his attorney because he didn't trust Vancouver police. 2 weeks later, Cindy was found unconscious and half naked in her garage. She had been hogtied, and a black nylon stocking was tied around her neck. By now, police were really suspicious of Cindy. So she decided to file a complaint against them, alleging that they dismissed her claims. In January 1989, Cindy's life insurance guy moved into her basement. On April 8th, a security guard at Richmond Hospital, where Cindy worked, discovered a note on the premises with cut and paste letters that said, "Soon, Cindy." Someone had also written, "Sleep well," in the dew on her car's windshield. Following a reported attempted break-in at her house, the RCMP used sniffer dogs to track the alleged intruder, but found no trail. The following month, police used sniffer dogs again after another reported break-in and were able to track the scent of an unknown individual that led over the backyard fence of Cindy's house. That same day, she had scheduled to have an infrared detection system installed at her house for security purposes and planned to spend an evening with the Woodcocks. After not hearing from Cindy, they went to her house at about 10 p.m. and discovered that she wasn't home and her car was gone. The Woodcocks drove past the Blondale Shopping Center, which Cindy often went to, and found her car in the parking lot. They immediately reported her missing. When police examined her car, they found blood on the driver's side door. There were groceries and a wrapped birthday gift inside. Items from her wallet were found under her car. Police searched her house. It was clean and orderly and filled with numerous houseplants that were well taken care of. The Canadian Coast Guard searched rivers in the area and the Georgia Strait. Several days after Cindy was reported missing, her insurance guy told police that he had received a call at his office from a man claiming to be her father, and he wanted to know about her life insurance policy. The insurance guy's secretary informed the caller that he would need to visit the office, as private insurance matters could not be discussed over the phone. Cindy's father later denied making the phone call. On June 8, 1989, a municipal worker discovered a decomposing body in the backyard of an abandoned house in Richmond, BC, that was situated along a busy street near an intersection. The body was in a fetal position and hogtied with rope. A black nylon stocking was tied tightly around the neck, and a coat was found near the body. The pathologist who examined the body at the scene noted that the hands had been bound so tightly that one finger had scratched another down to the bone. A pinprick consistent with a hypodermic needle was located on the inner right elbow of the body. On the property, police found graffiti in orange spray paint that said, "Some bitch died here." A line, spray painted along the ground with the same orange paint, ran from a fuel tank to the spot where the body lay, encircling it. Inside the abandoned house, someone spray painted the word devil. The deceased person was later identified as Cindy James. An autopsy determined that she had died of multiple drug intoxication from substantial amounts of morphine, diazepam, and flurazepam. Her blood toxicology report showed that she had 10 times the lethal dose of morphine in her bloodstream. Based on an examination of her stomach contents, the toxicologist determined that Cindy had orally ingested about 20-30 milligram tablets of flurazepam, in addition to numerous tablets of diazepam, a combination that was lethal. The method by which the morphine had been administered could not be determined, which baffled the pharmacologist who analyzed the toxicology report. Traces of morphine were found in Cindy's stomach, though the pharmacologist stated that the amount could have resulted from intravenous injection of the drug. By his analysis, if Cindy had received the morphine via intravenous injection, she would have been unconscious within minutes and would have died within several hours. Authorities concluded that the overdose had been so large that there was no reliable estimate of how long Cindy could have remained functional before losing consciousness. The RCMP said Cindy's cause of death was likely suicide or accident, based on their assumption that she had fabricated her 100-plus claims. Her private investigator, Ozzy, who visited the morgue to examine her body, said, "There is no way that she could have been able to, after ingesting that amount of drugs, tie herself up. Nothing at the crime scene to indicate that she had used any needles or drinking device." A memorial service was held for Cindy in June 1989. 2 days after what would have been her 45th birthday. Police surveilled the memorial service using hidden cameras, which captured the faces and license plates of all who attended. An extensive inquest into Cindy's death was undertaken in the spring of 1990 in Burnaby, which consisted of 5 jurors and featured testimony from over 80 witnesses. Among the evidence presented were 2 recorded phone messages Cindy's ex Roy had received on his answering machine. On the witness stand, Roy testified that Cindy's father physically abused her when she was a child and that one of her brothers molested her. He also accused the police of attempting to frame him. During the trial, it was revealed that shortly after her death, Cindy's parents discovered a huge stash of various medications in her house, including sedatives and antipsychotic drugs prescribed by her psychiatrist, and they flushed all of it down the toilet. One of her sisters found a glass cutter in Cindy's purse, along with a medical syringe kit, a urinary catheter, and saline solution in her bedroom. Jurors watched the footage of Cindy's body at the scene and listened to numerous accounts detailing her mental state leading up to her death. Cindy's cop boyfriend testified, "All along, I thought she was holding back or concealing information that could solve the mystery," Constable McBride said. Some psychiatrists presented the theory that Cindy suffered from DID and that one of her personalities was trying to destroy the other. But her psychotherapist, Alan Connolly, told Unsolved Mysteries, "In all the time that I saw her, there was never any evidence that she had other personalities." Cindy's longtime psychiatrist, Dr. Wesley Friesen, stated that he suspected she had borderline personality disorder with elements of post-traumatic stress disorder. By Friesen's account, Cindy possessed a tremendous amount of rage towards her father, and based on their numerous sessions, Friesen believed there was a strong likelihood that her father sexually abused her when she was a child, though she never indicated this was the case. Not expert Robert Chisnell used the same length of nylon binding Cindy's hands and feet to show the jury how she could have tied herself within 3 minutes before the drugs in her system took effect. After deliberations, the jury concluded that Cindy's death was the cause of an unknown event and classified it as undetermined. The RCMP formally closed the case. Vancouver Sun reporter Neil Hall said, "It's been estimated that police spent $1.5 million investigating Cindy's complaints. She reported more than 100 incidents, yet they could never find a suspect. There was no sighting of a suspect, no fingerprints." Cindy's family and friend Agnes Woodcock were adamant that she was murdered, despite having no proof. In 1994, Oprah interviewed a woman whose story is similar to Cindy's. For 4 years, Ruth Finley thought a maniac was stalking her. It turns out she had DID, and she alone was terrorizing herself without her conscious knowledge. Ruth had another personality, a man who she called the poet. She said the other personality set her house on fire, left Molotov cocktails in her yard, and informed the health department that she was spreading venereal disease, among other horrific acts. She went to the police to complain about the harassment, and they tried in vain to find the culprit. One day, Ruth drove to the woods and stabbed herself in the back 3 times. At the time, she thought someone else had attacked her. Luckily, she made a full recovery. She underwent years of therapy and was able to integrate back to one personality. "Some of the stuff that happened, I never really remember doing that," Ruth said. For more information about dissociative disorders, visit the National Alliance on Mental Illness at NAMI.org. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to tune in next time for more intriguing mysteries from around the world.